Welcome back to Vincharoa. Did you enjoy the short break? It's all getting rather serious now. No second chances, it's do or die time at Italia 90 as we kick off the knockout phase in the south of Italy. First in Naples, as everyone's new second favourite team, Cameroon, take on the equally talented but just as unpredictable Colombians. Then it's over to Bari to see if Costa Rica could conjure up another upset to take out the quietly fancied Czechoslovakians. As we know, there's a lot to look forward to in these latter stages. Keeping me company today and helping me dissect what happened on June 23rd is Simon Hart, author of the brilliant World in Motion, The Inside Story of Italia 90. Are you ready for the knockout stages, Simon?
Yeah, very much so, Mark, yeah. Looking forward to this.
Right, well, let's dive straight into the afternoon's offering from Naples and what looked like being a cracker of a tie between surprise Group B winners Cameroon and Colombia, who scraped through an admittedly tough Group D in third place and could be absolutely anything on any given day. In the first half, Colombia certainly made most of the running, with forward Carlos Estrada looking particularly lively, carving out several opportunities for himself and Luis Fajardo. Cyril Makanaki went close for Cameroon after great work down the right and a cutback by Francois Oman Biak, the hero in Milan in the opening game. The shot should have hit the target when he blazed over. Just before half-time, Freddy Rincon smashed a free kick off the Cameroon post, with Thomas Nkono beaten all ends up. After the break, the ill-fated Andres Escobar had a long-range effort saved by Nkono, while Oman Biak almost put Cameroon ahead after getting onto a lovely through ball by Stephen Tator, only for René Aguita to advance and put him off sufficiently at the crucial moment. The talismanic Roger Miller, the 38-year-old president's pick, made his now customary late entrance from the bench on 54 minutes and began to make things happen up front as Cameroon began to claw their way into the game. Simon, outfield players go on a lot longer these days, and alongside the fact that I'm not 14 anymore, I think Roger Miller doesn't seem that old at all. But his age was such a big deal in 1990, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it really was. I mean, I think the comparison with Beckenbauer is quite telling, because Beckenbauer at this point was Germany's manager, and yet he'd been the European Footballer of the Year, I think, in 1976, which is when Miller had been African Footballer of the Year. So, I mean, that sort of tells us a little bit, or, you know, it gives a gauge of just how, you know, old in sporting terms he was. I think maybe it was a bit similar to if Kevin Keegan had come out, you know, retirement to play for England, or if I'm guessing in 4 years time Wayne Rooney comes back and plays for England, you know, at Euro 2024. So yeah, we could just say in short, yeah, it is a big thing.
Well, Gion Kep had a free kick saved comfortably by a subdued to that point René Aguita, who must have been itching to break out his special moves. Both sides made the two allotted substitutions in normal time, so as the game headed into extra time deadlocked, it was the men on the field that had to make the difference. I seem to remember it being a bit disappointed with the 90 minutes of this match. I don't know about you, Simon. Sunny Naples, two of the most colourful, memorable kits of Italia 90, two teams blessed with attacking verve, but they just seemed to be happy cancelling each other out. Was it a case of the famed negativity of 1990 again?
Yes, you know, a different kind of football, you know, very hot temperatures, you know, slow game, slow build up. I know the Colombia were capable of that, you know, that slow quick thing where they, you know, they suddenly got their passes going and sort of, you know, moved the ball forward really swiftly. But yeah, it was like then, you know, you talk about the kits, you know, these fantastic colours, and those kits always look better, you know, on a sunny day. I don't think it was like that when, you know, Oxford United played in yellow against Luton in orange, you know, in a muddy manor ground in the 80s, but certainly in Naples, you know, it's quite sexy, really.
Yeah. So here we had our first knockout tie going into extra time, and everybody watching was desperate for the fireworks we'd all anticipated to come to fruition. Very early in the second half of extra time, it was that man Miller who provided the spark, dipping his shoulder to evade one man, hurdling the lunging tackle of another, before creaming a beautiful left-footed drive into the top of the net past the Colombian keeper. Cue the now famous corner flag celebration as Miller swiveled his hips in jubilation once more at his brilliant strike. Over to you, John Helm.
But I'm sure all those players will be hoping that just one of them can conjure up a goal from somewhere. There's that man Biak we were talking about. Miller, good turn. Miller inside the penalty area. Aguita up the line. Roger Miller's done it. He's the only swinger in town.
Simon, for me, this goal epitomised what we'd come to expect from Roger Miller. And I've been racking my brains to come up with adjectives to describe it that don't stray into the territory of cliche. But it was pure elegance and fluidity of movement. The way he just glided past the defenders. I mean, and that finish, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, I probably live in, you know, cliches as a journalist, but yeah, I mean, feline, would that be a good word for him? You know, just incredible nimbleness, you know, with which he moved, so quick, so light on his feet. I mean, I remember speaking to him about that goal, and I don't think he's ever, you know, he's not a shrinking violet, he's not necessarily, you know, a champion of modesty, but then why would he be? But he sort of said, you know, I'm the only person who scored with a 1-2 to himself. You know, Pelé didn't do that. I don't know whether it was an intentional 1-2, but that's, you know, that's the way it turned out. And you know what an incredible goal.
Just a couple of minutes later, there was even more drama and another of those iconic moments Italia 90 is best remembered for. Colombian keeper Higuita reverted to his old tricks, passing the ball around his back four while miles out of his area, seemingly without a care in the world. I think we all know what happens next.
And Higuita seems to want to get involved. I do not believe it. He's thrown the chances away now. That's it. 2-0, Roger Miller, and that is always the danger. Roger Miller makes this World Cup belong to Cameroon. They know now that they're on their way, I'm sure, into the quarterfinals. Higuita distraught.
As John Hell rightly intimates, Miller was the last person you should have invited onto you while dilly-dallying on the ball so far away from your own goal. Higuita's heart must have sunk into his boots, shame his brain didn't, as Miller waltzed off with the ball. It was a mistake as big as a house, said Higuita afterwards. Well, he wasn't wrong. It didn't deter him, though. He continued to play the maverick, although there is an argument, Simon, that he was actually way ahead of his time for goalkeepers.
Yes, and I think it's an argument that he would probably advocate more loudly than anybody. I had the fortune to meet him at the World Cup draw in Moscow a couple of years ago, and one thing he said to me was that if I was playing today, I'd be in Barcelona's team, and that he was very much ahead of his time. And, you know, fair enough, I guess looking back, you know, he was very much so, you know, played with his feet. He was willing to try things which other people, you know, weren't doing at that time. This was still, you know, 2 years before the change to the back pass law. You know, fair play. He was very much a trailblazer in that respect.
So Roger Miller, with his fourth goal of the tournament, wrote himself into World Cup folklore, while for Higuita it was a place in the Hall of Shame for that mistake. Valeri Nepomniachtchi's side looked destined for an unprecedented trip to the quarterfinals for an African nation. No longer were they simply a surprise or even lucky to be there. They were there on merit, and nobody would look forward to trying to combat their mixture of physicality and finesse. There was still, however, time for a Colombian lifeline with 5 minutes remaining. Their other main man with the trademark big hair, Carlos Valderrama, was instrumental in them getting a goal back. After a neat 1-2 with Bernardo Redin, he showed his poise and precision, slotting a perfectly weighted ball back into the path of Redin, who lifted it over Nkono as he came out to narrow the angle. A frantic, edgy finale to extra time ensued, with Colombia desperately looking for an equaliser to take the game to a penalty shootout. Sadly for them, yet happily for those neutrals invested in the Cameroon fairy story, it didn't come, meaning Cameroon would advance to play either England or Belgium, again in Naples, in the quarterfinals. We're going to talk more about Cameroon in just a minute, but let's first summarise Colombia's World Cup, Simon. They'd shown glimpses of what they were capable of, both the good and the bad, and with Carlos Valderrama, they did have a genuine world-class talent in their ranks. The squad would improve in time for USA 94, 4 years later, enough so for the great Pelé to suggest they could even be good enough to win it.
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, you know, such a talented team. I think it was their first World Cup for 40 years, maybe. Or is that wrong? Maybe we'll have to check that. But certainly for a long time, they had talent. They had clearly a top-class operator in Valderrama. One point which Higuita made was that Valderrama was the only player who had that the experience, you know, of playing really, you know, top class football regularly, and the others didn't quite maybe believe in themselves. They had talent, but perhaps not the discipline or the nous, you know, to do it at that, in that kind of a tournament. But yeah, no, I remember they beat Argentina 5-0 then in the qualifying for USA. And so much was expected of them for that World Cup, which obviously went horribly wrong with the, you know, the tragic, awful, you know, postscript of Escobar being murdered back in Colombia. So yeah, I mean, we could do a whole episode, you know, just about Colombia and what became of that group of players. But certainly, you know, people saw not just two players with these, you know, these very big haircuts, but talent and flair and, you know, but these maverick qualities which people do admire and get excited by.
Joining Simon and I to talk more about the Cameroon story is Martin Atonge, a sports journalist in Cameroon who has worked with several national and international news outlets, including the BBC, and now works for the Cameroon Football Federation, where he has held several positions, including director of competitions, team manager of the national teams, and above all, general secretary of the federation. I'm really pleased to have you on, Ventura Martin. How are you?
I'm fine, Mark.
Very good. So I suppose we'll start off with quite an obvious question. Realistically, what did Cameroonian supporters expect from their team at Italia 90? Because, okay, they performed very respectably in the 1982 World Cup finals, and they'd won the African Cup of Nations twice in the intervening years. But was there really any hope that they could advance beyond the group stage?
To be realistic, no, I don't think there was really any hope about that. We were, at that time, radio commentary was very available. We were only 5 years into TV broadcasting, and you could get the feeling the population was not really expecting anything that big.
I wonder if I could ask something, because I remember when I was in Yaoundé, and in the National Museum there was a photograph of the Omen Biak goal, you know, in that opening match against Argentina. Given what you've said about people not expecting something so big, just what was the reaction like at the time when, you know, when you beat Argentina?
Yeah, everything changed after that game. Everything changed after that game. Expectations went high. We beating the world champions 1-0, and the team was looking promising. Physically very robust, the kind of game we love. Our players were strong, and after that game, the expectations went high. We're confirmed with the second game, with the win in the second game, and from there on, everybody thought we were going to win the World Cup.
Well, as you said, Martin, that win, it wasn't a one-off against Argentina. The results kept coming. And even if you could dismiss that opening match victory as lucky, there was certainly nothing lucky about the win over Colombia in the first knockout round. Describe for us the effect that had on the Cameroonian people the longer that the team went in the tournament, because as I understand it, this was really the first World Cup finals that a lot of the people were able to watch live on TV.
Yeah, as I said, everything changed after that game. The public euphoria went high. There was another point, let me contextualize it also. We were entering into multi-party democracy, and there was a lot of social unrest during that period, June 1990. And the fever that was created with that social unrest was now transferred over to football. And it made many people to forget about all the public demonstrations calling for multi-party democracy. One party had launched itself a month ago in Bamenda, something that was very strange in the political landscape. And six persons were killed during their public launching, and it ushered in all the unrest. Those who were contesting, clamoring for multi-party democracy, and those who were against it. Of course, we had a one-party state, and all that shifted to anyway, not really shifted, but I can say the public, the victories came to kill that part of the social unrest, and everybody was now looking up to football to sort of unite the country. That was almost getting disintegrated with public demonstrations on the political landscape.
I love that word you use there, fever, because I remember seeing some of the footage of the supporters celebrating these victories that we saw on the news over here in Europe, and I think it had that kind of feverish excitement about it. So that's a great word, great description. Of course, we can't talk about Cameroon and 1990 without mentioning Roger Miller. And for me personally, I think he'll always be the greatest Cameroon footballer, not Samuel Eto'o. Miller had already had a very good career, both for Cameroon and in French club football and Cameroonian club football. And he played for the likes of Monaco, Saint-Etienne and Montpellier. But in his mid-30s, he decided to take himself off into relaxed semi-retirement and for some sunshine in the island of Reunion in the Indian Ocean. Why did President Paul Biya plead with him to come out of retirement for Italia 90? What was there anything he said, or did he promise anything to Miller to do so?
There was nothing public about Paul Biya's intervention in getting Roger Miller into the squad. Let this be clear. I don't think, and public knowledge holds it, the President of the Republic did not intervene for him to leave retirement and return to football. The President of the Republic intervened for him to be admitted into the squad, because Roger Miller was already out of the squad, and the other players who had been active didn't want him back into the squad. That one is public knowledge. Most of the players have said it. The group that was in camp did not feel the need to have Roger Miller in the team. And that is when the people were campaigning for Roger Miller to be in the squad, took the matter to the head of state, and he had to say, okay, see if this guy is ready, let him be in the squad. And then it came now like a presidential fiat that he has to be in the squad. And that is how the other players backed down from their camp, that they didn't want him in the squad. Wow. So it was not bringing him out of retirement, but bring him into the squad.
Wow, it's really interesting you say that the other players weren't really very keen on having him there. How would the team have done, do you think, in 1990 if Miller had decided, or the coach had decided to go against that lobbying to have him there? Because he really was a special ingredient that gave them just that something different to what was already a good mix of skill, physicality, and of course good coaching.
Well, now we can say that it may have been different. You really never know what the outcome of a game until it's displayed, and you really can say that if Roger Miller was not there, Cameroon would have done better. You can also say for sure that Cameroon would have done worse. So we were lucky he was there and did the show he did, did the performance he did, and then it helped us reach the quarterfinals.
Well, he scored four times in Italy, and of course we were all blessed to see him perform that now famous celebration dance each time. Was that something he'd done before, or just something that he'd spontaneously done when he first did it, and then because it kind of mushroomed into that enduring symbol of Cameroon's incredible story in Italy?
Roger Miller himself has never been able to say categorically whether it was spontaneous or he planned it. He had planned to celebrate his goals that way. But one thing is certain, he had never done it before, and he only started during the World Cup finals 1990. And now, was it spontaneous, or he had planned to celebrate his goals that way? We don't know. We don't know. He's never really said it himself. But I want to imagine, I think he was spontaneous.
Martin, I'll never forget our visit to Roger Miller's house in Yaoundé. Still can't believe I got there. But one question for you about the impact of Italia 90 on him personally. I mean, did it change his life? Did it help him become a rich man to sort of to take advantage of the profile that he gained from what he did in Italy?
Well, one thing I would say for sure is that I think his financial situation did change. Did he become a rich man? Well, you know, the definition of riches, it depends on what you want to say about riches. But he gained more than he had gained during his professional football career after 1990. Not only the financial reward from the Cameroonian part, but there were several other donations from rich Africans. I can remember the late Biola, the very rich business Nigerian businessman, invited him over to Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And he made a huge donation to Roger Miller, and there were several other donations coming from other African countries for him. And of course, he changed his financial situation, and he was able to have a better standing on retirement.
And speaking of that, what is Roger Miller up to these days? Because I imagine that, you know, if he steps out of his house, he's recognized, idolized, and probably mobbed wherever he goes.
Yeah, one other thing he gained from that performance is that later on, the head of state was able to appoint him what we call a roving ambassador. Not really a football ambassador, although he's from football, so many people have tend to say it's a football ambassador. But it's just a political post. It's, you know, it's like a minister without portfolio. So he has an office at the presidency. I don't know for sure how many times he goes there. But at least that one guarantees him all the perks and advantages and salary that comes every month for his upkeep. Ensures that he has a residence, official residence, official car, the kitchen, driver, and all the perks that go along with that. So he's on the government payroll. That one alone, it's enough recognition, people think. Several other legends of his caliber have been dreaming to also have such official recognition, to have that kind of status. But for now, the head of state has only thought about Roger Miller. So that makes him comfortable. That now there's a social recognition of everywhere he goes, and people invite him even to birthday parties, marriage ceremonies, and people just want to associate with him. I know he makes some money out of his image too. He's had one or two business deals in Cameroon and abroad, involved in projects, involved in UNESCO things. He has an NGO, Cœur d'Afrique, that deals with taking care of street children, health issues, and so he's got all that recognition, and he's a friend to everybody. Of course, at one time he was also honorary president of the Cameroon Football Federation, but he clashed with the managers. He's out of it. He came back a little bit, not in that official role, but still playing a role within the federation, and that too crashed out. So he tried to back a candidate during the recent the last elections into the Cameroon Football Federation. He was backing Joseph Antoine Bell, who was the goalkeeper during these days in the national team. They failed, and he was very bitter about it. And somebody too also speaks out his mind, so he has a few enemies and a few friends.
What did Italia 90 do for the generations of Cameroon players that came after? Because of course, I'm sure it acts as a huge motivation and inspiration to show them what they can achieve. But I guess it's also a bit of a millstone around their neck, because they've all now got to measure up against the feats of 1990.
Yeah, as you said, I think it became the measuring rod. You had to attend that if you want to become a footballer in Cameroon. You had to, at least, that was a minimum standard that had been set. And so it was all motivation, and everybody looked up to becoming national team. player so that you could be recognized. The achievement was big for Cameroon. It put football on the front line. The government now decided to put a lot of money into it, although most of it may have been mismanaged or stolen outrightly by even people in government. And well, football became that big, but we have failed to develop the industry itself, and we still look upon government to bring in money, and everybody knows what it means, government subsidies into something which could become an industry and which could finance itself and make a lot of money for not only the players but all those who work in the industry. So it became very big, and at the same time it cost us a lot of problems, which I think we've not yet found the solutions to those problems.
Martin, could I just ask you there, you speak about problems. I remember you telling me the expression chop broke pot to sort of encapsulate some of the things which went wrong after 90. Could you just explain exactly what that means?
Well, it simply means, you know, stealing the hen that lays the golden egg, forgetting to know that you will still need some eggs tomorrow. So you eat up everything today and everything is dead, and tomorrow you are still hungry, so you just have to go and steal again. It's a problem, and we saw that in the next World Cup, 1994, where the government was running into a crisis, and there was this big call for public funds, for public support, and Cameroonians came out to contribute millions of francs CFA. I think we were able to put, the government never gave an account of that money because the money was stolen outrightly. It was scandalous. The money that was collected by Cameroonians to support the operation or the World Cup, the team in the World Cup competition to pay bonuses and all the other costs that go along with it. I can say 90% or 95% of that money was stolen by government ministers. It's public knowledge, it is known, and that led to quarreling. I think the everybody knows what happened with the Cameroon team in 1994 World Cup in the USA. The team were quarreled, there was infighting, even the coach could not be paid. The coach, at the end of the competition, the coach never returned to Cameroon, Henri Michel. He went straight to France. He was insulted by players and managers. There was fighting between officials of the delegation. The minister who took the money from Cameroon to the USA never gave an account, and everybody said the money disappeared between Paris and New York. So it brought the team into limelight. At the same time, people with very huge appetite for theft went into the football to loot, because the football had now shown that it could respond, it could well, the industry could produce money, but some people came into it only to steal off the money. And till date, as I said, we have not been able to solve that problem, because it's the same pressure. People who simply want to loot the coffers of the federation are putting on the federation. A lot of political intervention, sometimes maybe purposefully to just destabilize the smooth functioning of the federation. A lot of political intervention directly into the management of the national team that causes problems even amongst the players. And consequently, we have not been able to get any better result during the World Cup. Even the Nations Cup is true. We managed somewhere along the line to win two more Nations Cup, three, but look at our performance in the World Cup. Once there is a World Cup finals, we enter serious problems.
Are there any lingering regrets about the England game in the quarterfinal? Because even here in England, most observers acknowledge that we were lucky to beat Cameroon in that game.
Well, the regrets are still there, but I think with the years, too much water has gone under the bridge, and I think people have forgotten about it. Especially with the disappointing, the only disappointments we have in these days, and only when they think about the match that they regret coming. It's true, we everybody who saw that game and who had watched that game of our generation, let's say all the managers, football and players who watched that game, of course, conclude that we had to beat England. We had to beat England. It was just the normal, usual African mistake of failing to keep concentration until the last minute.
I guess you know or have certainly met most of the players who were at Italia 90 for Cameroon. I'm sure they must have some great stories. Can you tell us any of the best ones?
I will only say what I have heard from other players. And the main story was just the conflict in having Roger Miller in or out. Okay, once that was settled, the other conflict was with Joseph Antoine Bell. He was the number one goalkeeper, but he made a public statement that, which some people felt that it was it destabilized the team. He said something like, I'll paraphrase him, that we will not be able to cope with Argentina. Something like we were going to lose. And the authorities felt that was not psychologically good for the team. And the coach was again instructed to drop him as number one. And that's how Thomas Kono came in as number one goalkeeper. But at the time, the coach was preparing his team until the eve of the game, because there was a quarrel, Bell Joseph Antoine was going to be the number one, was the number one goalkeeper, but was dropped on the eve of the game and even kept out of the team. He never trained again with the team. The players, for solidarity's sake, had to insist that his bonuses also be paid, because the officials said they were not even going to pay him bonuses like the other players. The players insisted that no, he's already in the team, so he stays with the team. That's how they were also able to solve that one. So Bell Joseph Antoine stayed with the team, they didn't train, and he featured in no game, but received his bonuses.
Sadly, big defender Benjamin Massing is no longer with us. He's going to be remembered forever for that simultaneously shocking but hilarious challenge on Claudio Caniggia in the opening game. I'd like to think that his death was mourned appropriately in Cameroon, and that his teammates and the coach, Valerie Nepomniachtchi, who is often forgotten, I think, in the story, are still well revered over in Cameroon. Do they all still get that reaction from fans if they see them in the street or on TV and so on?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it is dying down because, you know, the generation, the young people who are active now, who move in the street and who can recognize you, don't know them well. Don't forget, it's 30 years gone. So those who are, let's say, up to 25, who are the vocal supporters now, were not born then. So they don't seem to know them yet. Those who are interested in the history, of course, the journalists, most of the people recognize them. Of course, when there's an occasion like the passing away of Benjamin Massing, that is when some of the history is brought back, and people will pay their respect. Another member of the squad who passed away, I think it's Fidelio Paul. He was very vital in changing the tempo of the match, because he did a very spectacular dribbling at the midfield and gave enough courage to the team to be able to put up a good fight against Argentina.
Finally, Martin, we've seen Nigeria and Senegal do well at World Cups, and Ghana have since matched Cameroon by narrowly missing out on a semi-final place in 2010. The importance of Cameroon and what they did at Italia 90, and the legacy for the whole of African football, it's unmatched, isn't it? It just changed the perceptions, particularly outside of Africa, about African football that had gone before, and set the tone for now what we see, where a lot of the African nations are expected to do well at World Cups, and of course so many African players populate the big clubs in Europe. It can never be underestimated the impact that that team had 30 years ago.
Sure, it's never underestimated, and I will tell you something from experience and from what I've gathered in all these years of interacting with other national associations. I can say for sure that the whole of Africa, the football community in Africa, strongly believes and think that Cameroon remains the flag bearer, and only Cameroon will be able to carry African football forward and make it bigger in the international scene. I don't know what, but all Nigerians, you talk to Nigerians, Moroccans, they always feel that Cameroon is disappointing the continent. All of them are looking forward to having Cameroon in the finals. The South Africans will tell you that if anybody, any African country will win the World Cup, they are expecting Cameroon to do that. All because of 1990.
Well, Martin, it's been brilliant to have you on. Our time's up for today, and it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you and to reminisce about the Indomitable Lions, Roger Miller, and the sheer joy the Cameroon team not only gave to the people in the home country, but also to millions around the world. So thanks again for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Martin.
Over in Bari, the new spaceship-like stadium welcomed its biggest crowd to date at Italia 90, over 47,000, to watch if another of the group stage surprise packages could continue their unexpected progression through the tournament. Costa Rica had certainly proved themselves as worthy of being there, but I imagine the bookies would have had Czechoslovakia pinned as firm favourites, and it didn't take them long to justify the confidence, just 11 minutes in fact. Lubo Moravcic, with his silky left foot, delivered a delicious cross into the box from the right, which was met by a towering header by their target man, Thomas Skouravi. The Costa Ricans held firm thereafter and got to half-time still in with a shout, despite being second best. They even had the temerity to bag an equaliser 10 minutes after the interval. Another inviting ball in from the right from a free kick by Hector Marchena was bulleted into the net by the head of Ronald Gonzalez. Suddenly, the Czechs had a game on their hands. That parity lasted just 8 minutes, though, as some defensive folly on the part of the Costa Ricans, who were trying to play the ball out from the back, Harlem Globetrotter style, led to a spot of head tennis, as commentator Brian Moore described it, in their own area, which results in that man Skouravi using his head again to deftly finish at the far post to restore Czechoslovakia's lead. A third came on 76 minutes when Hasek was crudely hacked down by Marchena 25 yards out. Lubos Kubik took aim and curled an absolute beauty over the wall and into the top corner with his left foot, leaving Hermidio Barrantes, the injury replacement for the excellent Luis Conejo in Costa Rica's goal, watching helplessly as it arrowed past him. If that wasn't game, set and match, 8 minutes from time, Skouravi leapt highest again to head another home, his third, from an in-swinging corner. Five goals for him at Italia 90, four of them headers, top of the scoring charts, the second and last hat-trick of Italia 90. He was proving to be lethal around the six-yard box, but that was all owed to the quality of the delivery from wide areas. That cultured Czechoslovakian midfield was on fire in the first four games, and West Germany or Holland were waiting for them. And bar the Italy game, a few had looked as potent as Czechoslovakia in attack, although their opposition was notably weaker than others. For Costa Rica, it was a wonderful adventure, one that was wholly unexpected, and in fact, it inspired a film all about Los Ticos' Italia 90 campaign. Simon, looking back now, was Conejo's absence from this game vital?
Yes, I mean, he'd been the man who frustrated Scotland in that that pivotal opening win they had. He ended up in the FIFA team of the tournament, the squad of the tournament, as one of the best two goalkeepers in the World Cup. So absolutely, they lost a key man, and they were playing against, you know, a big striker, the kind of tall, you know, aerially dominant European striker who they probably weren't that used to in CONCACAF. With all due respect to, you know, the USA would have had Bruce Murray, but you know, generally speaking, you know, the players, the strikers they were used to dealing with would have been smaller, more nimble, nippier than, you know, this huge Czech bloke. So yeah, definitely they missed him, and that was crucial to you know, what became quite a big defeat.
And what about coach Bora Milutinovic's influence? We know he'd been there and done it, so to speak, with Mexico in 1986, and of course he was headhunted by the USA to knock them into shape for the 1994 World Cup that they were going to host. He was the proverbial gun for hire, but boy, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, they'd done incredibly well just to get to that World Cup, but you know, Bora took them to another level. I love the story of him, you know, taking the squad into the mountains of Costa Rica, I think around February time, and you know, the lead up to 1990. They went to the mountains. They trained two or three times a day. At night he'd show them the Rocky films, so you know, they were doing the complete Stallone thing, you know, Rocky IV style training programs out in the woods, and then watching the films at night. So yeah, they that was one thing, and I think he taught them not to just be satisfied with being qualified for a World Cup. They played against some big European club sides in the run up to going to Italy, one player told me a story about, I forget the name, but they played into Milan, and you know, Bora said to them before the game, you know, I don't want you swapping shirts with these interplayers, because you know, you're the international team here, they're just a club side. So really trying to make them, you know, aware of not feel daunted by, you know, these European teams that be up against, to have a sense of pride in themselves, a recognition of that, you know, that they were a team to be respected, and that, you know, that bore fruit at that World Cup. And I think for Bora himself, you know, who's, you know, a little bit of a, we might think of him as a I don't know if nomadic precedes Bora in his passport name, but you know, this globe-trotting coach who's been to World Cups for different countries, I think for him, he said that was his greatest achievement in a World Cup, to take that Costa Rica team, you know, into the last 16.
We haven't talked too much in the series so far about Czechoslovakia. So while they're on their way to the quarterfinals, it's about time we remedied that with the help of Czech reporter, fan, and former spokesman for Slavia Prague, Ondrej Zlamal. Thanks for being with us, Ondrej. How are you?
Yeah, fine. How are you? Thank you for the invitation.
Perfect. All right. So politically speaking, Czechoslovakia, like the rest of the old communist bloc in Eastern Europe, was in upheaval around the time of Italia 90. How important was football and that World Cup to people in the midst of all that uncertainty?
You know, that was one of the tournament, most fantastic tournaments I remember, because it came, you know, in 1990. In 1989, there was a Velvet Revolution, so it was the fall of communism. There was the time when the World Cup took place. There were the free elections, and everything was like new, and the people were allowed to travel. I don't know if you can imagine it now. Like, there were 25,000 fans traveling to Italy just to watch the games. When I was growing up, I was like envious that the pundits and the commentators, the journalists can come to Western Europe and watch the games. I was envious because nobody could travel with the Czechoslovakian teams, because we are not allowed simply to go to the games. Last time there were 2,000 people. It was 1934. 2,000 fans traveled to Italy in 1934, and after that there was no crowd at the major tournaments for supporting Czechoslovakia, my country. Actually, in 1976, when Panenka and his team won, they lifted the trophy, there were actually like about 20 or 25 fans from the embassy in Belgrade. So just there was no one. We just could watch it on TV. And the World Cup came in this hectic time, this freedom, and the people could travel to these games. And when I saw the fans in the stands, and they shouted, they supported Czechoslovakia, I had tears in my eyes. It was like visualizing embodiment of the freedom, of the new freedom, because the people were there. And there are a lot of stories about the fans who could travel to Italy and support the team. When I spoke to some of the players who were there, they had tears in their eyes when they went, when going to the stadium and they saw the Czech people around them. They couldn't believe their eyes, and they really, really wept, and they had tears in their eyes to see the people who have just made free, who won their freedom again.
Wow, incredible. As you said, they must have some amazing stories to tell, having been shut away almost from everything outside of Czechoslovakia. And I guess, were you able to travel to other Eastern European countries at that time?
But you could, but you know, there was no good football at the time. You know, just we could. I remember I went to East Germany, and I went to Bulgaria, and it was that was it. You needed a special permit to go to Western Europe. I actually played handball. I don't know if you know the sport. This is the Olympic sport. I played handball to be allowed. Just my motivation was to be allowed to travel to Western Germany, because that was my dream. And when I was 16, because we played the top level of Slavia, the youth team were allowed to go to Nürnberg, and I crossed the border. And when I went to the street for the first time, I went to the shops. Yeah. This is very difficult to describe today. When I tell it to some young people, they don't believe me, actually. But back to the football, there was 25,000 or 30,000 people traveling to Italy 90 from Czechoslovakia. And this is the record number, which cannot be broken again, because we would never get so many tickets. And the people traveled to Italy because they wanted to see Europe. It was like part of tourism, because they could cross the border, see the countries when they were traveling to Italy, you know, see Germany, Austria. I don't know how they traveled there. But they made a touristic trip. And actually, it was the time they didn't have enough money, because the currency was not that strong. So just they had to take a lot of food with them. Mm-hmm. When the Czech team arrived to Florence, it was like a Czech city. Everybody sitting in the park eating what they brought from home and getting ready for the games. This will never happen again, because, you know, today when the Czech fans travel, they travel in numbers, but not in such big numbers. But they always sit in the bars and enjoy drinking beer and everything.
Yeah. Well, in the West at least, Czechoslovakian sides were always viewed as a real danger at tournaments, although more so at European Championships than World Cups, oddly. They would often be referred to as the cliched crack Eastern European team. Were they fancied to do well by people at home, particularly after making such quick and easy progress through their group?
Well, yes, there was a very talented side. I think that most of them, you could see that after the World Cup, because many of them went abroad, almost all of them got a contract, and they went to play in Western Europe. We saw this generation as a very talented one. There was a story with Knoflíček and Kubík, the guys who emigrated in 1988, a year before the revolution, to England. They couldn't play, and they joined the team again. And it was a very talented side. And we still have a kind of bitter feeling about how they didn't go further than they actually did. Yes, the expectations were very high, especially after the group when they crashed the United States. There was a lot of expectations and excitement about this side. And I remember that one of the group of fans, they were having a banner walking in the street. It was there was the World Cup 1934 silver medal, and there was the final, and it was the World Cup 1990 Italy again, and they expected final again. So just like the people were optimistic about how far they can go.
Well, it's kind of a way, it's not surprising, because you had some great players, especially in midfield, a lot of creatively talented players, and of course the Czechoslovakian star was the striker Tomáš Skuravý, who really made a name for himself at the tournament.
Yes, a mighty, mighty forward, and we nicknamed him Bomber. Which was he scores fantastic goals, and it was actually, when I mentioned Knoflíček, he was like added to the team, and he was fast winger, fast forward, supporting him, providing him the crosses, and we knew that if the ball goes to the penalty area, when there's Skuravý, he can score goal, because it's impossible to stop him. Because you know, you couldn't couldn't find some a defender who would be able to stop Skouravi. Plus, this team got in a very good form before the tournament, and during the tournament they improved. And yeah, that's right. Skouravi was a hero, national hero at that time.
Yeah. Well, in episode 3, we highlighted the unusual circumstances of Ivo Knopfler's Czech and Lubos Kubik. And countries like Romania and the Soviet Union as well were beginning to feel the influence of outside money bearing down on the lives of the players. Did Czechoslovakia have that same situation going on at the time? And do you think any of the players were thinking about their own futures rather than the World Cup itself?
That was a turbulent time, you know. This is again difficult to describe now to today's people, the young people, because you know what happened to the players. That sometimes somebody came to me. There was an agent, and he offered him a contract, and the money they received was like 50 times more than they received in Czech Republic or the Czechoslovakia, or maybe 100 more. You know, just amazing money. And it's like, of course, they thought what they are going to do after the World Cup. But when I spoke to the players, and I believed that to them, that the teamwork and the team success was the most important thing. They were a very good team. They were like friends and inside, and they pulled together during the tournament. And all of them knew that if they qualify to quarterfinals, if they go forward, qualify from the group, that they would get better offers. And it was a craziness after when they qualified, when they beat Costa Rica, actually. It was crazy. Like there's a rumor that the coaches were on the top floor of the hotel, and they were watching around, and they were just trying to prevent the managers and agents coming to the hotel and grabbing their players and taking them away to discuss the contracts. You know, just like it was a craziness. Like yeah, it was really crazy. But I on the other side, I believe them that they were a good team, and they just thought about the success of the national team. They didn't think selfishly about what is going to happen with them.
Well, Josef Engloss, or Dr. Engloss as we came to know him in the UK, he was the coach, and immediately after the tournament he became the first non-British or Irish man to manage a club in the English First Division when he took over at Aston Villa. He was in his second spell in charge of the Czechoslovakian national team. Tell us a bit about him and the style in which he wanted his team to play.
You know, the first thing, like they worked together with Mr. Ježek, Václav Ježek, the coach. They won in Belgrade 1976. They won the gold medals. There was a rule that one of the, in Czechoslovakia, during the socialism, there was a rule that one of the, if the head coach is Czech, the assistant must be Slovak. And they swapped roles, but they actually worked together. Even he was head coach for some time, and he wasn't. That was just like we had two coaches at the time. He was Wenglosh. He is a very educated man. He was a university tutor. He was a midfielder actually when he played for Slovan Bratislava in his career, and he probably found the thinking of like coaching about tactics. He was always very well prepared for all the games. And after finishing his playing career, he went to Australia, and he played there in Sydney as a playing coach, and he learned language, and he always was methodically prepared. He wanted the players to be responsible. He always analyzed the opponents. He's the author of the saying that there are no weak opponents, because he was like following how the other nations are getting better and better. So just he was like a perfect match for Václav Ježek. Actually, after 1982, he was supposed to take over Portugal national team, but the communist regime, because the Czechoslovakia didn't do well in Spain in 1982, so they prohibited him from accepting the offer. But he was supposed to get such a prestigious place. Then he went to Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur. He was actually in Portugal, in Sporting Lisbon. So he had a lot of international experience for being coach abroad, you know. Educated guy, as I say, you know. He wanted the players to be responsible. He wanted them to play tactically well. That's what he was known for. Actually, I also found in his profile, which I found out before this, that he was very successful with Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, and he was offered to take Barcelona. He couldn't get this job, but at one point of his career, he could go to Spain and be in with Barcelona.
Well, you touched on it just then, but the squad was finely balanced in terms of numbers between the amounts of Czechs and Slovaks. Was this a deliberate selection policy at the time, and were there any known tensions or cliques that formed in this two-nation scenario, especially as Czechoslovakia as a combined country was in its final chapter?
You know, they were not even called Czechoslovakia. It was a Czech and Slovak Federative Republic, because there was a lot of disputes and political quarrels about the name of the country, which started after the revolution, which was like quite annoying. I also asked the players about that, but they simply didn't care who is Slovak, who is Czech. There's no language barrier. Like, if you are Slovak and you speak Slovak, the Czechs understand. The Czechs understood Slovak, and there was the team. Like, if you played football well, nobody cared if you are Slovak or Czech. This was at that time. Like, there were of course some like quotas, and they wanted to be politically correct regarding what I said about the coaches. But as regards the team, I think the qualification to play in the national team of that time of Czechoslovakia, it was football. It was not if you are Slovak or Czech. Though of course the fans speculated that some of the players got the place because they are Czech or they are Slovak, that they needed somebody. But I don't think that this was like this way. And I asked Moravčík about that when we spoke with him recently, last year, when we met him in Nitra, and he didn't mention that. It was a very good team. It was a very good. There was a very good spirit in the team. You know, you have to remember, this is what Moravčík told me. This is very different to nowadays. That after the game, they sat together. They didn't have cell phones, of course. They didn't have anybody or no notebooks to do anything else. They spoke about the game. They spent time. They went through the next game. They talked about the opponents, what happened, what were their experience, and they. Like, this helped them to keep the team spirit, and I don't believe there was somebody was like saying to somebody that he's Slovak, he's Czech. No, they didn't have like groups in the team that some of them sat at one table, the other one sat at the other one. I don't think so. I know that for example some of the Slovaks were sharing the room in the hotels with the Czechs because they were friends from Sparta, for example. There was not a question of this, and actually it doesn't work even today when sometimes I cover some of the football, like second league, and I run into somebody, like I speak for the first time to the player, and he starts speaking Slovak. I just realize he's Slovak. I didn't care about if he's Slovak or Czech. I don't study that.
Well, Costa Rica were duly dispatched in the round of 16 in a very slick performance. Did anyone back home, either journalists or public, believe that Czechoslovakia had the necessary weapons to defeat either West Germany or Holland, who they would end up facing in the quarterfinals?
Yes. Actually, about Costa Rica, we were very optimistic because we were like we saw Skuravi's giant, and we saw the Costa Rican players are not that high, they're not that tall, that they wouldn't be able to stop him, even if they were taller, because he was in excellent form. And when we saw the small goalkeeper, well, he was not also very very. Very tall, this guy. So we were very optimistic about Costa Rica, and yes, there was about your question. There was in the game against Italy, we scored a regular goal, which was disallowed for offside. Nobody saw this offside. It was Grigas' goal, and we could have even beaten Italy. So just there was a lot of optimism even in the team again for the game against Western Germany. And up to now, when I still feel a bitter feeling that it was no penalty at all, that it was a dive, and Western Germany shouldn't have been given the penalty. And if the game went on, I think that could have been a big surprise that it would be equal to the last minute. So just like yes, there's some kind of bitter feeling, which for me is symbolized with Moravčík's boot flying, glossy shoe flying in the air. And we were not given penalty after that. And so one bitter thing about that is also the coach was, the referee was Austrian, and he spoke German, of course, and he talked to the players of Western Germany more often than to the Czech side, to the Czechoslovakian side. Just that was kind of a bitter feeling, like it could have been longer. But still, it was a tremendous success, and people were proud of the team.
Well, okay, there's another entry into the catalogue of Austria West Germany World Cup controversies then. Soon after Italia 90, the two nations split into their own entities, and it didn't take long for the Czech Republic to regain a lot of Czechoslovakia's international reputation, with them reaching the final at Euro 96. And they did so with an excellent generation of young talent, the likes of Patrick Berger, Karol Poborský, and of course Pavel Nedved. But there was no Tomáš Skoráři, the most remembered player from that 1990 team. He got his big move to Genoa shortly after Italia 90, and was still only 30 by the time of Euro 96. Wouldn't it have been great if they could have wheeled him out for one last assault on the German defence in extra time of that final?
Well, you know, the Tomáš Skoráři, his last game was in 1995. He converted a very important penalty against Norway. We needed to defeat Norway to qualify to Euro, but he was not the time at the time. He was not in Genoa. He was in a Sporting Lisbon, I guess, and he got injured his knee. His knee was injured, and he was not able to play. He didn't play even in Portugal and for his team. He was not fit to be the member of the squad in 1996. Really, really sorry for him. It was a big pity. It's kind of symbolic moment that he helped the team to qualify. He's converting an important penalty. It was the 15th minute, and he had the nerve to go and take it, and he scored. But it was his swan song for the national team. He was not fit for featuring in England anymore.
Well, Andre, our time is up for today. My thanks to you for coming on to the pod. Where can we follow you on Twitter to talk Italia 90 or Czech football in general?
I have two accounts, actually. The first one is @AndrasLamal, also one for my @UEFA.com/AndreZ. There I tweet in English. You can follow my tweets, and if you are interested in how they will do the Czech team, so just that's everything about Czech football.
There's just the one listener's question today, and it's from @Troisey16. And it's this: what were Roger Miller's stats playing in the Reunion First Division after he moved there from France? Well, firstly, we have to mention his longevity. He made his debut for Leopard Douala, I hope I pronounced that right, in 1970, and didn't finish playing until 1996, age 44, where he was still banging them in Indonesia, better than a goal a game. But the specific question, Wikipedia tells us that he scored 8 times in 23 games in 1990 for champions Jeunesse Sportive Saint-Pierroise. They're an interesting club in their own right. Their alumni include 3 high-profile French internationals: Djibril Cissé, Dimitri Payet, and Jean-Pierre Papin. And so that takes us on to today's trivia, and it can only really concern one person. Cameroon's hero, Roger Miller, won all sorts of team and individual awards during his football career, both before and after Italia 90, most notably the Africa Cup of Nations and the African Footballer of the Year award twice each. Away from the game, he was also honoured by France, where he spent a large portion of his time as a player. In 2006, Miller was awarded the Chevalier, or Knight, of the Legion d'Honneur, similar to an OBE or MBE in the UK, I suppose, for his services to sport. Coincidentally, on the very same day that this was bestowed upon Miller, Michel Vautreau, the French referee who sent off two of Miller's Cameroon teammates against Argentina at the opening game of the 1990 World Cup, was also given the very same prestigious award. Well, we're all off to celebrate today's show with a little dance around a corner flag somewhere. But before we go, I just want to say thanks to my guests. Firstly, Simon Hart, tell us where we can follow you on social media, please. And then, more importantly, tell us where people can go and get a copy of World in Motion, because I believe there are some people who, incredibly, don't have it yet.
Ah, well, first, thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure. My Twitter account is... is at Simon22PH, and as for the book, I'd probably suggest right now you go online and you can get it there.
Excellent. At all good online stockists, and maybe a few bad ones as well, who knows. Our Twitter and Instagram is @VinciR90, and the podcast is exactly where you found us today and every other day. So do the honours, please, and share VinciR, and hopefully more people will get to enjoy our indulgent nostalgia trip.
Come back tomorrow, won't you? Because we'll be discussing the little matter of Brazil versus Argentina and West Germany versus the Netherlands. Exactly the sort of heavyweight clashes the World Cup was made for. Tasty, as they say. Ciao.